La Santa Maria County Board of County Commissioners, acting in its capacity as the Board of Human Services. Today is Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. It is now 1 p.m. We're calling this meeting to order. Please rise for an invocation by Commissioner Tony Haas, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance by Commissioner Robert Lucero.
Dear Lord, when we are given a cross to bear, help us to embrace it as you embraced yours. Give us strength and courage to carry it with resignation and unite our suffering with yours. Most merciful Father, also bestow on us the compassion needed to carry the crosses of others who are burdened. Help us to see that we are all one step away from where these less fortunate are. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, commissioners. Roll call, Mr. Aragon.
Commissioner Haas?
Here.
Commissioner Lucero?
Here.
Commissioner Lopez?
I'm here. Approval of the agenda. Do you have any changes to the agenda, Mr. Aragon?
Not at this time, Commissioner.
Thank you, sir. I will entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
Move to approve the agenda.
A second.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Mr. Lucero?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez?
Yes. Before we get into the section two, I just simply want to welcome our Commissioner Robert Lucero to this board. And I'm looking forward to working with him. The opportunity to have communication, so invite him to have a one-on-one. I think the opportunity with DHS, it's one of the most complex operations that I've ever worked with. There are so many line items, so many rules and regulations, state, federal. So please extend an olive branch. And just want to say welcome, sir, and I'm looking forward to the next 4 years. They're going to be a bit challenging from the perspective of the federal government as well as the state, but I know that we can get through this. So welcome once again, sir. So now we're going to go to the section two, November 19, 2024, the regular meeting minutes. Do we have any questions on those minutes, commissioners? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve the November 19, 2024 regular meeting minutes.
I'll second it, although I'm probably going to abstain from voting on it.
I got you.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. 2B, December 17, 2024, regular meeting minutes. I will step down as the chair and make that motion to approve them.
Second the motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes, and point well taken, Mr. Lucero.
Thank you, sir.
At this time, we're going to open the floor for anyone here or online that would like to address this board under public comment. You would have 3 minutes to address the board, the Santa Maria County Department of Human Services. Here and now, we're going to go to the next item, director's report, Mr. Aragon. By the way, really want to thank you for those ongoing meetings that you and I have. It gives me so much the opportunity to ask the chair of this board to go and do research and look at the challenges that you are facing that we as a county are as well facing. So thank you for that.
Certainly. Commissioners, again, this month I'm focusing specifically on our CCAP program and the funding crisis that exists. And also, Commissioner Lucero, to get you brought up to speed with a funding crisis that we've never seen at this level. Back in August, the department, the State Department of Colorado Department of Early Childhood, CDEC, released a memo indicating that a federal audit of the Child Care Assistance Program had created six findings against the program statewide. In those findings was several items that create workload along with additional costs to the county side. We're still investigating what that legality liability looks like. However, based on the federal audit finding, it was discovered that the state and counties were not reimbursing the providers. So such instances that our child care facilities are South Central Council of Government, our Trinidad Youth Club and others throughout the state were not being reimbursed at the federal rate of pay for each youth. Additional to that, the other audit finding was that a new federal rule also is impacting those audit findings where we move from our traditional pay based on attendance to a reimbursement to providers based on enrollment. So normally we have about an average of 22 days a month that the providers can bill towards the CCAP program. If a youth is absent, we do not get a bill for that day. We can, as a county, pay a certain number of days of absences. However, ours is extremely low. I believe ours is 2 absences a month that we would pay a provider. With the new enrollment, it no longer takes into account the number of days. It takes the entire month, and we pay per pupil a set amount. So with that provider rate increase, it created a cost variance in the tune of, and this was just released last Thursday to the state and to the directors, in fiscal year 2025, the original overspending of the allocation amount received is significantly higher than originally projected. For the fiscal year we're in right now, we are projected as a state to overspend by $17 million. In 2026, we will see another provider rate increase to bring us up closer to the federal level. And again, in 27, we'll be at the max. That will bring us compliant with the federal rule. At this point in your packet under the director's report section, I provided some projections. Now, I will update the board that because we are still under the attendance versus full enrollment for 2025, in reality, our overage will not be the 181,000 projected. We actually are pitted to be underspent based on our current spending month to month. However, that also brings a challenge because with CCAP, it is a TANF-based program, which also means that when we don't spend the full allocation, the state readjusts and takes away money from our allocation the next year. So I'm anticipating a 7 to 9% loss in funding allocation between this fiscal year and next.
So on that point, the challenge is going to be, should that 9 to 10% reduction takes place in 2025, the following year, your base funding is that much less.
Correct.
What happens when you exceed that funding thereafter? It comes back to the county. Am I correct?
Correct. Correct. So per state rule, however, though, there is a clause in the MOU agreements along with the state program rule that indicates that counties are not required and cannot be asked to spend beyond the allocated amount. That's fine. The question is, who's covering the excess cost, or are we asking providers to close their doors for 6 months until a new federal round comes in? It's not reasonable. Either way, you know, the county is on the hook to fund a program. We also cannot disenroll youth that are qualified for the program. So once they're in, they're in. The only way that they come out is either they age out, which is after the school age is met at 13, or they move out of county and transfer that case to another county. So originally we had planned to look at putting the program on a freeze. However, after reviewing current spending and also with our current allocation amount, what I'm going to present to the board in February is a wait list. We adopted a policy back in 2020. However, the federal government requires updates to that. So that will be coming to the board in 2020. That gives us a little more control that should we be able to balance out the program, if the youth leaves, we can put one in. Under a freeze, we have to lift the entire freeze. And that becomes a challenge because then, although we've calculated the wait list chronologically, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're able to place those youth. There is essentially an override to placement in the program if the child is qualified under either child welfare for protective service reasons or they qualify for our Colorado Works TANF program. So those youth take precedence over those that are on the wait list. Even during this wait list or freeze, we would still have to place those youth. So we can still see additional costs beyond what the projections are because of those youth qualified in that. As of right now, for 25-26, I am comfortable with the projections in 25-26 fiscal year, which will begin in October of this year. We are projected to be $292,000 overspent in the program. In 26-27, we're projected to be $371,000 overspent. And then that also continues beyond 26-27 because we have 57 youth enrolled between three providers, and those 57 youth are not planned to age out until around 2033 to 2035, 2033 to 2035. So it is going to hit us pretty hard. Now,
And that's also not including any potential youth that you can enroll, even though, I mean, there is a freeze.
Right. Even if we're waitlisting, it's still essentially freezing the program. It just happens to be that, let's say, we have 57 right now. I calculate it based on the high federal provider rate reimbursement. We would have to get our program down to approximately 18 youth is all we would be able to serve under the current allocated amount. So we are essentially cutting 30 to 40 youth out of this program to balance out to meet the allocated amount that we receive.
Is there any open window to take a look at other programs such as UBK at the state level from your perspective so we can transfer some of those funds to make these programs whole?
So I think there is. I think one of the interesting conversations I had, we held a meeting with Dr. Roy, who is the director of CDEC, the CCAP program director, Sarah Dawson. We also met with our local provider, COG, specifically because of the UPK reimbursement rates. So what we discovered in that process, it seems that many of the providers who enrolled under UPK at the time of its start, did not necessarily either have the technical assistance to provide to that enrollment process as a provider, or there were missing components. Unfortunately, because of that, our provider is only being reimbursed at a rate of around $9 to $11 per child per day, whereas some of our reimbursements on CCAP are upwards of $60 to $80 a day. So I believe also they were limited because there was 30 hours of UPK promised. Our provider was only approved for up to 15 hours a week. So those limitations have created a funding gap. In the future, also one of the federal rules was you couldn't stack. So essentially right now there are youth that are only charging 35 hours a week to CCAP and 5 hours to UPK. With the new federal rule, that goes away. So I think realistically, we'd have to look at the number of providers utilizing UPK dollars. What does their actual enrollment look like? What is their reimbursement? And if that program has excess funding in it, then the request would be counties reaching out to the JBC and looking at potentially moving funds from UPK over to CCAP.
What is the response from the JBC? I mean, I know there is, it's a pretty well balanced group there.
I think they realized the deficit and the funding gap. I think the problem is that there are so many other programs statewide that are either on the chopping block or have seen significant decreases. As you and I have discussed, Commissioner, there's about $1 billion deficit on the Colorado budget this year. That includes partly UP, CCAP, excuse me. I think the JBC has done what it can. In the sense of with the other cuts, we were able to procure, Sarah Dawson was able to procure an additional $10 million towards CCAP, but that's split between 64 counties, so that's not a whole lot. Additional to that, I was informed that the federal government has provided $250 million subsidy to Colorado or to all 50 states that have the program, but that means Colorado's only going to be in receipt of 2 to maybe $3 million, which is not going to be much. Even with that, we're still going to be 5 million over budget on this year's deficit. So this is a significant impact to us as a county. It's a significant impact to our youth. The secondary and tertiary effects are significant as well when we have single parent homes who are returning home to take care of their child instead of being in the workforce. So we anticipate throughout the state seeing unemployment rates rise in areas. We've already seen classrooms and other providers closing. JeffCo has closed several of their CCAP classrooms down already. And they've been on a freeze, I believe, to date. There are 7 of the 11 counties that are on a freeze. The $17 million overage is from the big 11 counties. That is primarily where those overages are coming from. I know El Paso County, Adams, are projected to be $4 million overspent each at this point in the next year, in this fiscal year. So it's a challenge. It absolutely is. I have been, I think, in every CCAP meeting I could possibly think of, childcare meeting, funding meeting. I attended the JVC hearings virtually. We were providing data and information to CDC with the JVC hearing. I work and serve as one of the rural representatives for the program at this point in the funding crisis. So it's Los Angeles County's the small and medium sized voice at the table for the rest of the balance of state counties right now. Welcome. I see Commissioner Haas taking deep breaths over there.
So at our winter annual, at CCI's winter annual, we had several individuals that commented about the DHS shortages and funding shortages and how they were going to implement freezes. Are they going to do something similar, like Jeffco with Ed Kerry Warren Gully from Jeffco?
Yeah, Commissioner Warren Gully and Jeffco have already been on a freeze on their CCAP program. Adams, El Paso recently went on a freeze, I believe, in early December. One of our local news stations picked that story up, and so there was information about the El Paso freeze. I believe Pueblo is going to possibly go on a freeze as well, or a potential wait list. They are traditionally underspent, but also what we've seen because of this funding crisis and the kind of the shutdown of the acceptance of the program, waitlisting, non-traditional applicants are coming out of woodwork in certain areas. So we're seeing applications coming in, and unfortunately, we can't turn those away. So my hope is that either the federal government, there has been some ideas tossed around that perhaps with new administration, the federal may not require Colorado to implement the current federal rule until we balance out because of the funding crisis, which would be very helpful if we could retain or remain on paying based on attendance right now versus the actual enrollment. That would be a huge cost savings to not only the state, but the counties as well. I just feel like this is unfortunately a perfect storm with a lot of storms converging at the same time that are not helping us. I have communicated to the state also from the Los Angeles specific perspective is that we also saw such a huge hit to our assessed valuation and we lost a quarter of our tax revenues this year. And that impact alone is going to be a huge detriment to us as a department and as a county. You know, I've worked with Finance Director Coberly, and as I've mentioned in the past, you know, we did provide a part of the mill back, but ultimately for us to meet the continued MOEs, at some point we're going to have to get that half back because it will start to impact us as an agency on the services we deliver and whether or not we can stay in compliance. So we have a lot of challenges ahead of us, and it's going to take everyone within the county to make this work.
I have mentioned to Mr. Aragon that I have personally invited Representative Jeff Hurd to join us on March the 18th at the meeting, and I'm hoping that he's going to accept the invite. I had a personal conversation with him on the phone, and so now I send him the official invite. What I asked Mr. Aragon to formulate a couple of good questions or statements for him so he can get the federal delegation in Washington advocating for the counties on this particular issue, whether it is to bump up the regulations from being implemented right now, whatever the case may be. So I'm hoping that he's going to accept the invite. I haven't heard anything. I know they've had a couple of busy days, but definitely I'm going to remind him again and hoping that he wants to be here personally. He wants to make kind of his day if he can get away. But if he's not, I think he'll join us virtually. So We'll keep you posted. And then on that perspective, I wanted to hear from the community, not necessarily just DHS, but we'll invite others like the college. What are they going through? What are some of the messages? The Chamber of Commerce, because he's really interested in finding out what is ailing to his district. And I hope that he will be the voice to at least give us a little bit of a, if nothing else, recognition. And then I also have an appointment with them as I'll be traveling there next month. I was hoping we were going to be sitting down with him, but nonetheless, if his calendar is open, I'm going to go sit down with him. And then, of course, remind him of that. So between now and then, Mr. Aragon, if you want to write something, I send there our way. I'll be going there March. We still have another month. But nonetheless, I think the federal delegation needs to hear this and needs to know what's happening, because there's going to be a point in time that counties cannot longer sustain the expenditure and the mandates. We're just not going to be able to do it. And then for us to go back into the streets and ask our constituents, hey, we're going to raise your mill levies because we are short of, that is going to be kind of a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah, I think a couple things in addition to that. One, in your packet today, I do have a letter on behalf of the Board of County Commissioners. Commissioner Phoenix Lopez, thank you for the feedback on that. In support of a request of the JBC, similar language was sent on behalf of several other counties. And additionally, I sent a letter that is, again, in your packet today for your review, but that was sent to Representative Ty Winter. Mr. Winter's office is still working with CDC leadership to schedule a meeting, as he would like to sit down with them. In addition to that, just to let the board know, I will also be serving on the Colorado Department of Education Early Childhood Independent Evaluation Steering Committee. So every so many years, based on House Bill 22-1295, the CDEC was established and launched in 22. We have to provide an independent evaluation of CDEC's performance in executing required governance function and its operating effective programs and services. So as a committee member, it will be an opportunity for us to provide that information and to gather that information from not only our providers, but from our families and from those who utilize the programs through CDEC for its effectiveness.
How many members serve on that board?
I don't know the exact number. I know it's made up of large county DHS directors. I am representing all of the small and rural balance of state counties outside of the big 11. And there are providers on there. There are families on there that provide that evaluation process, so info on that evaluation process.
And let me go back for a second and get a clarification on the CCAP. You said that the Big 11 are the ones that are going to be basically overspent. How does that translate to the rest of the counties?
So essentially, when the larger 11 are overspent, and keep in mind, we also saw in this last year a reduction to our TANF reserve ceiling. So in that packet, I also provided you with those numbers. We saw a decrease in the TANF reserves. So there's state TANF reserves and there's county level TANF reserves. Those TANF reserves are used primarily, Commissioner Lucero, in the event of a natural disaster. If the commissioners declare a state of emergency for a forest fire or recently our snowstorm, we can enact those funds and our eligibility department can then utilize those funds to stabilize the community. That's folks that are affected that need food stamps or SNAP benefits, as we call them now. If there's a housing crisis, we need to put them in hotels, whatever, we can utilize those funds to help stabilize during that state of emergency. With this program, we can also use those funds to backfill the overages. What that creates, though, is that concern that if we have a natural disaster and we need to utilize those funds, then they're gone. As of right now, it's projected that county TANF reserves will be depleted within a year and a half's time. So it is a fine balancing act. What I do plan to do is, in what these numbers don't take into account, the overages for 26-27, is we are traditionally underspent in our Colorado Works program. In the last 2 years, we've sold off a portion of those to the tune of between $75,000 and $125,000. We will not be selling off our MOEs anytime soon because the excess from Colorado Works is the only program that I can use to either backfill childcare and or child welfare block grant. So I'm going to utilize those excess funds from Colorado Works to then offset those costs as much as possible so that we're not eating through DHS's fund balance and trying to keep out of the county general as much as possible. We've worked very hard in 5 years to put the fund balance in place that we have, but with the current overages, if we didn't have the excess from Colorado Works, we would be depleting our fund balance within about 3 years' time and then hitting county general.
Kind of a footnote, not related to anything, but I'm thinking of Mr. Lucero. Would you send once again to the three of us the encyclopedia, the glossary, the terms, the documents?
No, there is a quiz on that, by the way. It's six pages, but we'll get it to you.
I failed. Yeah, this because I remember the day, you know, talking about CCAP and CDC and TANF, and you go on and on and on, and it's like, send that to all three of us again. We need to take that quiz again.
We will do so.
Council?
I see the little red. Are we muted or are we not?
No, we're on.
Okay, I just saw the little red in the corner.
That this one here?
No, on that corner there.
That's Ms. Garrison, but she's muted.
Okay.
That's why. No, that's okay.
Popped up big screen of work, so I've got a little bit.
I probably would have had comments already since you're not on. I think we're okay. So that is a rough, down and dirty intro to CCAP and where we're at funding wise. Additional to that, I just have a couple other items to address. I'll have my staff that were able to attend both online and here today. I've asked them just to present information on, introduce themselves and information on the programs they oversee. But additional to that, I will be out of the office the next 2 days for some medical procedures. So Interim Deputy Director Ms. Eklund over there will be in charge tomorrow as Mr. Bertolino is out as well, and on Thursday. So if there's any cause or issues, please reach out to them in my absence.
Wish you well.
Okay. Any questions? Additional concerns? It's a loaded question.
It is. No, thank you so much for that report. We are going to go now to the consideration of financials. I think we had postponed those for a couple of meetings. Financials and bills for the month of October 2024.
So,
well, good afternoon. How are you, ma'am?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
Good. So we have the correct October financials in front of you. Does anybody have any questions? They on page 89 of the packet are the corrected financials. So the last meeting we included the county financials, which should not have been included.
Right,
so
right.
We did get those corrected.
And thank you for doing the cleanup on that. Much appreciated. I don't have any questions, commissioners.
No questions.
See, that seat is getting from hot to warm. I like that. So, okay. Questions, Commissioner Haas?
None.
I'll entertain a motion to approve the financials and bills for October 2024.
I move to approve the financials.
Bills for October.
Yes.
Second the motion.
Okay. Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes, thank you. Back to you, Finance Director. Consideration of special payroll, CYD, on call November 1, 2024.
So for the special payroll, we had $1,221 and $1,221.10 for the CYDC juvenile on call. Any questions?
What is CYDC?
I was just say to clarify. So Commissioner Lucero, CYDC is our, I knew you were gonna ask that, it just flew out of my head. It's the youth The chair of the committee. Holy smokes, it just blew out of my head. We work with the third judicial, providing on-call services for our youth that qualify for the detention. If they meet a detention requirement, our staff go out and they meet with them and do an intake screening. That is what the CYDC does. So our child protective services staff are the ones who do that.
Good say.
It will come to me at some point. About 15 minutes down the road, that name
is that back the Kalawari Youth Detention Center?
It depends. Yeah, so it's a pre-screen to determine whether a youth is required to attend a detention center. If they require that level of service, if not, then our screens them out. And we work with the Third Judicial, primarily Ms. Priman, Liz Priman in the Third Judicial. She's over that program as director. Okay. I'm on the committee. And so this is actually reimbursed. So this is 100% from the judicial that pays this payroll. It's not actually a county funded portion of their payroll.
Mr. Lucero, anything?
No.
Thank you. Any questions for Finance Director? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve the special payroll of CYDC on call November 1st, 2024.
Second.
Okay. Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. Consideration of payroll for pay dates November 15th and 29th of 2024.
Okay. For November 15th, 2024, our payroll $114,951.38. And for the payroll on November 29th, 2024, $116,922.13. From your packet, as you can see, that the payroll for the 29th did include the longevity pay.
How is that? And I know that's countywide the same for the correct for longevity pay.
It is.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Sicklin? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
I move to approve the payroll for pay dates November 15th and 29th of 2024.
Second motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. New business, consideration of caseload counts and activity by program June and July. Back to you, sir.
So, commissioners, two things. One, it is the Colorado, thank you, Lori, that triggered it. Colorado Youth Detention Committee, CYDC. Thank you. What I've asked today in front of you, Commissioner Lucero, is several pages of our case counts. This shows you the volume that each of our staff worked with within the month by program. And so if you have questions on the numbers or if you'd like to sit down and go over those in more detail, I'd be glad to do so.
Maybe at the next meeting,
that's fine.
Once I get through kind of going through all of it.
Essentially, what you'll notice, though, is towards the end of that, you'll see a large report from our Division of Economic Security that kind of gives you an indication the number of clients we serve with open cases. I believe it's around 6,000 and some folks there. That is our largest in the sense of that's our SNAP and Medicaid programming, our long-term Medicaid programming, our adult financial program. So that is the total served is 6,672 open cases in the county at this point. Outside of that, the other program numbers are there for your review. That's the total amount for December that each of our programs served. And in this, I'll ask Ms. Ringo to start off, and then I'll have Ms. Chrissy, and then we'll go to online. But I just want them to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about the program that they oversee.
Hello. Commissioners, I think all of you know me, Laura Ringo. I've worked for the department for 40 years, and I'm happy to say that I currently supervise two programs for the department. The first program that I supervise is the Adult Protective Services Unit, APS. So, and we apologize that we have our own language at Social Services. In this program, it's a small program, but what we do is it is a a state mandated program. The county departments provide this. It's a state regulated, county administered program. And what we do is we investigate and address reports of abuse, neglect, and exploitation amongst our most vulnerable populations. And when we look at this, we have to also look at mandatory reporting. Any individual who is over age 70 or has an IDD diagnosis is a mandatory report to law enforcement so that they can look at it from a criminal point of view. And they have a different definition of an at-risk adult than adult protection does. So we always have to keep that in mind. Ours is more restrictive than theirs.
Law enforcement and DHS don't quite carry the same
definition.
Wow.
Yeah, which is really interesting. Yeah. And we receive reports of physical abuse, sexual abuse, self-neglect, caregiver neglect, and exploitation. Fortunately, we very seldom see physical abuse and very, very seldom see sexual abuse. And that might be an area that's hard for a lot of people to report. But we do see a lot of self-neglect cases. We see a lot of caregivers neglecting. And we also see a lot of financial exploitation cases. When we receive reports, we are obligated by law to report to law enforcement unless it's a self-neglect case.
Let me interrupt you there on the self-neglect. I would imagine it's by choice or simply because they kind of extrapolate on that just a little bit.
Okay, so self-neglect sometimes it's by choice and sometimes it's a result of a person having perhaps a mental health impairment to where they're not able to do that. And we always have to keep in mind too, that in the mental health system, there are individuals that have a diagnosis of gravely disabled, and that will be a lot of the same symptoms as self-neglect. So sometimes when we're looking at a case, it might be more appropriate to get mental health involved to see if they have more authority to force change than we could. Also, too, it could be that a person ages and they can no longer take care of themselves. They think they can, but all of a sudden, maybe they can't see. They can't see that their home is a mess. Maybe they've suffered a trauma and now they're into major hoarding. Maybe they just can't get to the doctor, they can't get their meds, and they don't have the capacity or the competency to be able to find a way to get those things done. And that, again, falls into our definition of what an at-risk adult is. Do they have the ability to do these things for themselves? APS is guided by three principles. We are guided by the fact that an adult has the right to self-determination. Sometimes when they have the ability to understand, they have the right to refuse our services, and they will sign a form that says they do not want our services. And we have to look at if they truly understand and know what they're signing. The next thing is least restrictive intervention. We always want to do no harm to our clients. We want to step in and assist them in a way that is least traumatic to them and that doesn't force or cause disruption to them. The least amount we can cause or do, the better off we feel like we are in helping them. The last thing is confidentiality. All reports to our unit are confidential. And I will make mention that in the Adult Protective Training Academy, where new workers go, one of the training questions is, your county commissioner calls you, they received a report, and they want information about a case. We cannot provide that information to county commissioners unless we have a court order to provide that information. So we just want to share that with you. Unless they've taken that out of the academy, I'm probably thinking about maybe going through a refresher. Our process is we get a call. Someone calls in a report of abuse, neglect, or exploitation, and we red team it. Do we have a mistreatment in this report? So today, if someone called and said, there is a 65-year-old lady who has no heat, you guys need to help. We need to find out, do they meet our definition about risk? And is that truly a mistreatment? We will always help with information and referral, but it may not rise to the level where we can open a case and truly get APS involved.
And not the time, Lori, but we get phone calls and usually we just forward them. And I don't want to know what happened, you know, from there on. I mean, and in our community, they're going to call the government.
Right. And actually, we have a case now that I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't reach out to Michael and she doesn't reach out to your commissioners.
Yes.
Right.
So, and then I think, you know, for the purposes of getting involved, you know, I historically listen to the message if it's a live phone call, but okay. And I usually just pass it on to Mr. Aragon.
And although we don't engage the commissioners in the details, I do or would put forth that every month the APS team has a community forum meeting that they meet. And that is a meeting that the commissioners could attend to get more information without specifics on the individual, but we do talk about the case or cases that have been challenging and work with other community partners to look at what resources or what they might be able to bring to the table to help facilitate care for those folks. Those are public meetings, anyone can attend them, but it is a great opportunity for commissioners to kind of get an idea of, without knowing the specific details of a case, what our challenges are in those cases.
I'd be interested in.
Yeah, and our next meeting is next Wednesday. It's always the last Wednesday of the month, except for December, at the community center at 8:30. And the meetings last, 8:30 to about 9:30, 10. We will ask all participants to sign a release of information. Sometimes people can figure out who we're talking about by the information we share. We don't share identifying information. And we do share scenarios. Like right now, we have one scenario, the one I'm talking about, where the person may reach out to you. This person truly believes that Adult Protective Services should help her, but she can access resources on her own. And she's in a bad situation. And we actually called a mini multidisciplinary team last Friday to bring in all the involved professionals to try to staff it and to figure out a way to help. So we do try to find ways to help. And eventually, unfortunately, this particular person will come our way. And I wouldn't be surprised that if, and sorry, Pam, but we probably will have guardianship of this person when she does lose decisional capacity. There is no one else. And guardianship is our only way to force change from a court point of view. But for guardianship, we have to prove that this person is lacking competency, mental capacity. So we need medical documentation and information. And we have to show that there is no other resource. Sometimes we have family situations where there's family conflict and they want us to assume guardianship because we would be the neutral party. We cannot per our rules because there's other family members involved. And guardianship should always, again, be the last resort. And we cannot take guardianship per our rules just to make medical decisions. We get calls frequently from the hospital saying, you guys got to take guardianship to make rules, to make decisions.
You know, I'm going to go back to this, the definition, because now I'm going to ask counsel, why are we dealing with two different statutes? One that law enforcement uses as far as the definition of neglect versus the one that DHS is using. I would imagine that it would be the same statute that governs whether it's negligence or one is...
One governs one entity, one governs the
other. Yes, okay. See? That was
and
easy.
So
do you get reports from neighbors, from law enforcement on
the
adult?
Yes, physicians, family members. Sometimes they are just so worried about mom, they don't know what to do, that they've tried and tried and tried. Mental health workers, law enforcement, the courts. The referrals come from everyone.
Do you call law enforcement to do maybe a welfare check on this person?
Sometimes?
Sometimes, yeah. It just depends on the situation. Oftentimes we find law enforcement's already been involved because there's been multiple reports for those types of welfare checks. In the instance we're talking about, that multidisciplinary agency meeting that happened Friday, we had fire department, EMTs, law enforcement,
mental health.
We had service provider agencies there.
Agency on
we
aging.
Brought all those experts to the table to try and staff this case because all of us are getting calls and calls and calls from this individual. Unfortunately, because that individual does not meet our criteria under APS for an at-risk adult, then ultimately we're trying to work with other community agencies that are encountering the same situation as we are as to how to support this community member and what can we or can we not do in that realm. So it is a very difficult, unlike child welfare, which I think is a little more structured in its rule and also because of the guidelines. Youth are under the age of 18. If we have to remove a child for safety reasons from the house or from the family, we can. In this instance, we cannot remove adults. We can't make that decision. And even with guardianship, as she mentioned, there are several things that we cannot do even with guardianship. We cannot take guardianship and try to place for mental health, like in a facility. We cannot place for substance rehab. So those are two areas that even as guardians, we have no decisional capacity to make. The medical provider or the mental health provider would have to make those recommendations. So we're also very limited in guardianships as to what our oversight is. Primarily it's financial and assuming or making sure that we have resources and services in place to support that person.
And then two, we are obligated by law to report because we are mandatory reporters to law enforcement, where when we receive a report, unless it's self-neglect, we have to report to law enforcement within 24 hours. So many times we will work with them. And one thing about Adult Protective Services is we have cooperative agreements with law enforcement. We'll need to update it with our new district attorney, with the police department, with the sheriff's department, of how to contact us, what to contact us for, because we do have 24-hour availability for emergencies. Also, who's going to do what? Are we going to do a joint investigation? Are we going to do our own separate investigations? So we have that cooperative agreement. We have one with the ombudsman who goes into the nursing homes and assisted living facilities to see if their role is usually to look for violation of rights. But sometimes they come across adult abuse, neglect, and exploitation. So we may have a common referral, and we would have to decide how we're going to investigate that. And also into our community center board, our CCBs. And so we have that in place too, where if we were to go into one of the group homes through Los Animas County Rehabilitation Center, how would we do an investigation there with their staff? So we do have those cooperative agreements. Under this program, there's no financial criteria. Abuse, neglect, and exploitation touches all economic groups. We always provide information and referral services, and we do try to provide community education and outreach. We are mandated to provide 5 events a year, and we hope you'll be able to come to our senior fair in June when we honor World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. And unfortunately, I would say some type of abuse, neglect, or exploitation most likely touches all of us. Just, I'm sure all of you see the scams on your phone where a package can't be delivered or, you know, the calls to the grandparents, your grandchild's in jail, rescue them, things like that. That's how it starts. And I have to say, there is a person that I think is the most amazing person in Trinidad, one of the smartest people I know. And this person, I don't know how they got to this person. It was almost like she was hypnotized. And this person was willing to walk up and down these hills and walk to Walmart from her home to get a gift certificate to help her grandchildren. And this is one of the smartest people I know and has been in high positions in the community and well-respected. And if they can get to that person, they could get to any of us. So that's a little bit about Adult Protective Services. Sorry, it took a little longer with that. I also supervise our case management agency. I'm one of the supervisors, so I supervise kind of half of the house. Our case management program is a program which we, Commissioner House and Commissioner Lopez, you remember, we fought hard for. And we had to fight to get the contract. And thank you to Michael's 100-page plus paperwork soliciting it. We were able to get the contract. We were surprised when Pueblo County was not selected. We wanted to keep this program in our community and accessible to our community. Huerfano County subcontracts under us. It's the entry point into Medicaid paid long-term care services. We help with home and community-based care services. We help with access into the nursing home. There's such services as consumer-directed tenant support services, CDAS, home care allowance. It's access to long-term home health, and again, nursing home placement. The mission of this program is to provide quality services and long-term care services to our elderly and disabled to be able to keep them in their own home for as long as possible. It's a continuum of services. Maybe at first they need a couple of hours of service, of in-home care service, per week, cleaning their house, helping them with the bath, running errands, to where maybe they need up to 70 hours of care services in their home. To determine the services, we have case managers that do assessments. They assess their needs. Their needs determine the hours of care they get or the services that they get or they want. We also monitor to make sure they're getting those services. If they become eligible for these long-term care services, it's a backdoor into Medicaid eligibility. To be eligible, we have to look at a person's finances. We have to get medical information from their physician. And we have to determine functional eligibility by the assessment. The waivers on our side of the house that I help with are the children's HCBS waiver. Children with life-limiting illness, which those two waivers are going to combine as of July 1st, 2025. Individuals with brain injury, individuals who are elderly, blind, and disabled, our most popular program, individuals who have community mental health support needs, and then Colorado Choice Transitions. There's a big push in the state of Colorado to try to deinstitutionalize any person in a nursing home to a home setting if it's possible. And if it's safe for that individual, and how can we look at those barriers and address them to help that person return home? There's various services we can provide. It may be placement at Legacy. It may be services through COG, Alta Vista Caring Angels. They are our care providers. It may be CDAS services. It may be in-home support services, such as with People Care. There's 14 agencies throughout the state that will come here and help with that. Long-term home health services through Sangre de Cristo Home Health, 30 days respite in nursing homes, home modification, which right now we're trying to get providers up and going to assist us with that. So if somebody can no longer step over their tub to take a shower but needs a walk-in shower, maybe we could add that or a ramp. The Lifeline necklaces, remote support, education. There's just a variety of services, and it depends on the waiver. I think that's all in regards to that. I could probably go on.
Thank you. You know, I want to make a point. Mr. Eric had shared with me last Friday an amazing figure, and I think we need to let the community know what this agency does. When he mentioned that Medicaid services in our community probably exceed $100 million, Medicaid, money put back in directly or indirectly, That is a huge amount of responsibility to manage those funds.
Yeah, and the management of that is partly on the functional or the case management side, but Ms. Garrison, who's online, her team is the one that generates that financial opportunity through their process of determining financial eligibility for long-term care Medicaid. Long-term Medicaid has a different provider reimbursement rate as well from what our traditional Medicaid looks like. So those rates are substantially higher when we're reimbursing folks in home that are caring for their elderly or aging parents or family members. Nursing home reimbursement rates are very high compared to the traditional. So it is a huge amount of funding that our department funnels through to our providers here, hospital, clinics, nursing home, long-term care facilities. The amount of Medicaid dollars that come into our community is vast. And it's because of this case management team and our economic security team that does the financial determinations. So
I would say we're probably putting in, and Michael, you may get a report on this, but I would say we're adding over $5 million a year in jobs.
So, and thank you. This is, you know, this is what I actually, we look forward to hearing these reports because it not only tells us what you're doing, but what the communities that recipient of. One important thing that I think is the program that you spoke about, the on the elderly going the adult back to the residence, right? The adult protective services. I mean, it is all well and good, and I hope it's not just an effort to save money on behalf of somebody.
Let's talk about the nursing homes.
Rules and regulations.
Oh yeah.
But at the end of the day, that's where an elderly belongs, at home. I wouldn't want to be, you know, I saw my father basically during the COVID years where he and I couldn't have any contact, but I saw what that did to him.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, whether it's money, that's what's driving this whole program, but that's where we all belong. In fact, that's where I want to be when I get to that perspective.
I think it's also important to keep in mind, and I'll have Ms. Marcy Mason, who's online, report on the other half of this program. But I think the intent of this program is also to the resources required to support our aging population is not sufficient in the state. And it makes more sense for family to care for their aging parents or family members versus putting them in a facility. There's also, from a legal standpoint, there's a moratorium on the building of new long-term care facilities in the state of Colorado. That's been in place for quite some time, primarily because nursing homes and long-term care facilities have a star rating. The state traditionally, as we've seen, most long-term care facilities are scoring on a 1 to 5 star, only a 2, 3 on the highest end. Their services are not up to par, not enough staff for the census in-house. So until those are increased to the level of service that's required, the state has put a moratorium on building new facilities. And so I think that's why there's also this push, because it's less resources to return folks from nursing homes that can go home with their family and be cared for versus keeping them in there. Because those folks who truly need to be in there, we can't get the beds in there. There's a bed shortage across the state with that. There's also bed shortages with our youth. That we see constantly. So it's a fine balancing act with this program, keeping our residents local and keeping the families, you know, paid for the services they provide directly daily for their family members is our primary goal through this program.
And it's hard too, because we get the other side of that where we see family members, it becomes about them and their paycheck and not about caring for that individual. So then we have those concerns, caregiver neglect concerns. So we have to watch that. And then also, in regards to your point, I was there when I watched the state director of Medicaid say, we are going to reduce beds at Colorado Mental Health Institute, and we are going to deinstitutionalize individuals with mental illness and let communities care for them in their community. Well, we don't have the resources in our community. And that was probably when it was a little easier like 15 years ago. And so they started deinstitutionalizing and bringing those individuals back to communities where communities are not prepared to take care of them and their needs. And I feel like that's part of our homelessness issue, is that we have those individuals out on the streets without the proper services, and we have no way to force them to get the services they need to be safer and to take care of themselves. So it's, and I worry about that too with nursing homes. Yeah, there are families that I've seen people be taking care of their families that go to the nursing home, they deteriorate, families go get them, take them home, and they pop right back up and excel again in a home setting. So, yeah.
So on your short tenure at DHS, if you go back to year one versus where we are right now, you can write a book, Lauren, and you can actually tell the continuum of services or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Erigan mentions that certain facilities are rated stars 1 through 5, 5 being mm-hmm. greatest.
Yeah, you can go to medicare.gov and you can look them up.
If you have to give APS a star then and now, where have you seen the services improve?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because when I first started, APS was just starting. And I remember they handed me some pages of a manual and said, try to do this the best that you can. And I remember getting called out in the middle of the night with an individual whose mom's boyfriend had burned him with a cigarette purposely because he was misbehaving. And I called my supervisor and I said, what do I do? And he said, just try to fix it the best that you can. So I pretty much called the police and we got mom's boyfriend to leave. And hopefully I think they did file charges, but there wasn't much we could do. We didn't have resources. We didn't have power at that time. Now, and I think Michael knows, one of my heroes is Peggy Rogers, who led the state up until a few years ago with her retirement. Everything I said I needed, she brought forth. And so she listened to the counties and she saw we needed resources. Are we perfect? No. Are we at a 5? No. But it's because, you know, we're in a rural area with a lack of resources, and that's not our fault. Or the, you know, the county's fault. We're trying, but we are much better than we were at the beginning. Much better.
This morning, I asked Commissioner Lucero what he enjoyed the most at the commissioner orientation, CCI. And he said the DHS presentation that they did. And I said, that's kind of like drinking from a fire hose, isn't it, buddy? And you got a taste of that today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, just on a personal level, a few of the programs that you're talking about, I'm a little more familiar because my dad was in. And it goes back, my dad was able to stay in his house for 5 years when he first diagnosed as with dementia. But he had a caregiver there, it was my daughter. But he was able to stay home, you know, for 5 years under his own roof. Unfortunately, we lost him last month, but I thank you for everything you did for it.
Thank you. And I think that's part of my passion and my drive is my own father passed away in 1987, and there weren't these resources. I couldn't keep him home and take care of him, and he had to pass away at the Veterans Hospital in Denver. So that has become my passion, that I share all information and resources I have in my head with anybody to help them. So thank you, commissioners.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask Ms. Chrissy to hold off, and I'm going to have Marcy online speak to the other half of the waiver services. And commissioners, I don't know. I thought we had another meeting scheduled this afternoon. Are we okay on time?
Yeah, you have, to be exact, no, the meeting was canceled.
Okay. I was like, okay.
I couldn't go there.
Marcy, if you could come off and speak to your side of the long-term care services you provide. And as she's coming on, Commissioner Lucero, just some quick background on it. We had to reapply for this program in 2021. We were awarded it in 1995, the long-term care program. We had to rebid for this. We were awarded this contract in 2022 and went through transition November of 22 into early 23. 23 into 24. In that, we also had to then absorb the waiver services traditionally provided through Los Angeles County Rehab and the Southern Colorado Developmental Disability Services Center, SCDDS, which Ms. Mason and her team were originally at. So I'll have her speak to that side, but we absorbed that staff, and we were so grateful to bring them on because this was a side of the waiver services none of us had any clue on. So we were grateful that the whole team decided to come over. And so I'll let her talk to that side. Marcy?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'm Marcy Mason. And as Michael said, I transitioned over in March from SCDDS with the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Services. We merged in with DHS as one case management agency, and I am the branch, the other side of a branch with Lori. I provide supervisory case management as well as case management to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I have case management. I have four case managers, and we serve. Oh, we have waiver services similarly to what Lori was talking about, but there you have to gain access by going through another step of determining an intellectual and developmental disability, which is complex, and it takes a lot of extra time and extra testing so that we can make sure the individuals are properly served. But we serve children and adults. And so we have the waivers that we provide are HCBS Children's Extensive Support, HCBS CHIRP, adult, and then we also provide state-funded services, which is family support or FSSP. And for adults, we provide SLS, which is supported living services, and HCBS Developmental Disabilities, which is access to 24-hour support. And then we have a state-funded state SLS program. And that is for usually while we're in the interim of determining Medicaid eligibility, we may be able to temporarily serve people, or if they are over resources and will never qualify for long-term care Medicaid in our state funded programs. However, the funds for those are very limited. So we try to ensure people are eligible for Medicaid or HCBS services as we can. We have, since we've come to DHS, we have, I looked at our case numbers and they're fairly consistent. We have people come in and out across the months, but we do have a waiting list for one program, which is the HCBS DD program. So that is a statewide waiting list. All of the other programs we can enroll in directly if they meet the criteria, which is financial eligibility. And then there's what they call targeting criteria for each program. So each program has different services, and they have different criteria that for which you need to establish to qualify. But the HCBS DD program does have a waiting list, and it is a statewide waiting list. So we are, anyone that applies goes into the pool that the state manages. And then when a vacancy becomes available or if additional funding becomes available through through the state, they will notify us, and we can authorize an enrollment if the individual on the waiting list is still interested in services. It's very similar. I won't go over it. It's the same process that Lori was describing for enrollment and It's similar. It's just a different branch, being that you have to have the targeting criteria of a developmental disability or a delay. So a delay is determined for a child between 0 and 5. At age 5, we use what we call adult criteria. You qualify, it's a lifetime determination. So you have to have that determination, and we have to look at their assessments and medical documentation and ensure that their disability is not solely a mental health issue or a physical disability. It has to be what they call a developmental disability, which occurs before they've turned 22 years of age. So I think that's just a quick overview. Does anyone have any questions? Or?
Yes, Marcy, thank you. You know, when you were talking about doing the diagnosis, whether it's an adult or a child, what agencies do you use? I would imagine it's a doctor, whether you're looking at a brain injury on an adult or you're looking at mental health on a child. Those agencies, are they, I would imagine they're at a fingertip, you know, a phone call or an appointment, ready to get in there and help you make a decision. Am I correct?
Correct. We use a variety of different sources, and it gets complicated, the rules regarding making a determination. It depends on how old you are, when you apply. You have to also show a disability before you turn 22, so you have to have historical documents. And we also have to establish what they call a neurological condition. So we're looking at medical records. Typically, schools provide testing, and we're looking at IQ tests or adaptive behavior tests. And the criteria is generally 2 standard deviations below the mean, which is, so like 100. If we would look at tests that their scores would have to fall at basically 70 or below. And we're finding the schools don't always do this testing that's required or necessary to make the determinations. Plus, there's some other standard error of measurements that you have to utilize when you're making that determination. So oftentimes we're referring these individuals out to agencies that do the testing. Unfortunately, the agency that we utilize most frequently is in Colorado Springs. So we are sending a lot of people out of town. I do have to say, within the last contract through HCPF, they did allow for us to be able to pay for some of the testing that's required. Medicaid will pay for it. However, sometimes we have individuals that are in the process of applying for Medicaid or don't have it. And so this would hold them up from receiving services. So now we're able to prepay for the testing, and then they're very quick, and their testing is right on, and it gets us all of the information that we need. So we need historical and current tests. So it's quite complicated. So actually, in the new contract as of January, because this process is so complicated, the state has required that we have all individuals that apply be assessed for HCBS services kind of initially and concurrently with doing an IDD determination, because it can be several months. And if the places that do the testing are backed up, you know, it could be several months before someone even gets an appointment. So we're adjusting to that. Between Lori's department and mine, we're trying to, currently we're figuring out some new processes.
So Marcy, when you're doing these waivers, is there a different providers for an adult versus a child? There is, okay. And since this,
they can be both. And typically the providers that Lori's programs use are not always the same service providers that we're able to use, because you do have to be go through the service provider process through the state. But
okay, and Mr. Arrigan, since this is a HCPAF program under their umbrella, do they, in the event that a client needs to travel to Colorado Springs, as Marcy explains, is there any compensation back to the county for those travel expenses?
We don't, so first and foremost, with these types of assessments, we don't transport the individual. The family and or
they do it.
A provider will transport them to and from their determination service evaluations. But we do, depending on the type of program, once they're in, we can reimburse through state SLS, through family support programming, or through some of the waiver services, supplies, medical equipment, if a wheelchair, shower chair, specific things like that are required. Medicaid will even cover the cost up to some mobility chairs, things like that, that our case managers will work with to authorize those types of either equipment or service to get them issued out and get them to the clients that they need.
So on the case of, in the event that you have an individual, whether it's a child or an adult, that requires services that are not provided within the community, and they need to be from, a brain injury in Colorado Springs, the program covers through Los Alamos County. You make all the arrangements for that individual to go through the treatment outside of county?
So, yeah. So if there is a medical reason why the provider is outside of the county, we don't schedule the appointment. That's really up to the family, the care providers that are there. Usually what we will do, though, is once they're on the program, if there is travel costs, if there's things like that, the program can cover that. If we have a family truly in need, we have a set aside fund that at the department that then they can bring to me. I know Lori's done it in the past. I don't think we've really had it yet with Marcy's team. But if we have a client who doesn't have those types of resources, then we will look at providing some kind of general assistance funding to that family to get them to and from whatever doctor's appointments they have, or to assist them if we can when they're not yet on the program. But that's very limited, and it's really a very special case that we have to show there's a real need for that type of service. But I will also say that some of our, I don't know on Marcy's side so much, but I know on like our side, because of the pandemic and because of COVID, some of our providers now are more virtual than anything that we've been in the past. And so some of our adults that we work with now know what a virtual doctor's visit looks like. And so we are able to get them in with providers via virtual if necessary. The IDD determination that Marcy's team does on that side is so much more extensive than what the HCBS waivers look like. There's a lot of work on this side alone, but then you add that to the IDD. And Ms. Mason and one of our other case managers are the only two that went through state training way back to help with the IDD determination process. So it's a very finite process that case managers go through years and years of training to get to the point to do the IDD determinations.
And so process. I think this question for either one of the two of you, I mean, on one end, one agency versus what is the life cycle of when you do this HCBS waiver? Are you going to have to do that one per occurrence, or is it on file for how long?
Each program's different in their timelines. There's a redetermination process that takes place once they're on services. And they're found financially eligible, then usually there's an annual review for the individual receiving services, both on a financial level to make sure they're still Medicaid qualified, and then again,
on the medical side to see
on the medical for what we call functional eligibility. Right. So it takes both our case management and our economic security team every year to go through that process for every case that we have on file.
This is like being a magician.
The work that my folks do from the top down is extensive. When you say this is and the compliance requirements is federal and state and is off the charts. When we talked last week, I talked about the compliance requirements for this, for these positions. It's unreal what we are required as an agency to provide to the state and to the feds in order to remain on, to retain these programs locally for our departments.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Marcy.
Sure.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Christie, do you want to give a brief overview of child support services, one of our other ones? And I do apologize, Ms. Tupper, our child welfare division of youth and family services, was at a staffing family this afternoon, so she wasn't able to attend. And so we'll have her update at the next one.
So I'm Christy Sarah. I'm the interim child support supervisor for our unit. And currently right now, our interim lead worker is Christina Dorr. And she's great. I love her. And we also have two legal technicians under Miss Christina, and that's Abigail Dorenkamp and Rachel Gonzalez. So I have a fabulous team, and everybody I think is kind of filling in their roles really well, and I think we're doing pretty good. Of course, we miss Valerie, but thankfully she's still in the building. So. That's wonderful.
Does she answer her phone?
She does.
Oh, very
and
good.
Sometimes I track her down.
There's no getting away.
No.
So this is where our programs cross with county, because legal counsel Nelson over there provides legal support for our child support programming along with our child welfare and adult protective services. So she is very busy with us on top of doing all the county side of it too. So if you really want to have somebody that can balance it all, I got to give it to that one over there.
Yes, we appreciate Pam.
So what Child Support Services specifically does is they help to either establish, to locate, or to enforce child support orders that are brought to us, either through a parent who's filing through our department, sometimes through child welfare, we may end up having to establish that. But Ms. Valerie Eklund has been in child support prior to her interim service now for how many years?
I don't know, maybe 25.
And so she just recently had to hand over the reins temporarily to Ms. Sarah here, who she has taken the lead, and I greatly appreciate her support.
Temporary.
And she's doing a wonderful job.
It may be permanent. We're in the process of search and screens right now. So we're hoping to have our deputy director of operations hired, and then we've got two other positions that are open right now that we're still search and screening. So,
there we go.
Yep. Any questions? Concerns?
Long term really took it out of all of us.
That's okay with me.
We'll get on it on another day.
Okay.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you. And then I'll just ask Ms. Garrison to give a real brief overview of her extensive list of programs as well.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, ma'am.
Okay. So I have been with the department for 33 years. I currently have a team of 17. And what Los Angeles County Department of Human Services does is help ensure citizens have what they need to live now and in the future. Our goal is to help put food on the table, heat their homes, receive medical care, find livable wage work, and afford basic necessities like rent, utilities, milk, and diapers. So Mr. Lucero, you're very new to this, and if you want to look at that list that's in your book, turn to the page and you can see all the programs that my team handles. There are listed on this 46 programs. You don't use number one because it's actually the header, but there are 46 various programs that my team is responsible for. We start with cash assistance programs, which is the Colorado Works and Adult Financial. Colorado Works is a cash program that helps eligible families with very low incomes to become self-sufficient by encouraging job preparation, work, and family stabilization. Eligible applicants receive a monthly cash cash assistance payment, as well as training and employment assistance. They are time limited. We knew this program as welfare at one point, then it went to temporary aid to needy families, and now Colorado Works, because they have time limited it to 5 years. It gives our unit those 5 years to prepare these families for finding jobs so that they no longer depend on this little grant to help them survive. I do have a lady that's based out at the Workforce Center. She helps, it's Susan, and she helps these families find jobs, prepare resumes, prepare for job interviews, how to dress for job interviews, that type of thing. So we're moving in that direction to where we want to help them, and they're encouraged to actually work with the Workforce Center. They have resumes that they can prepare and that type of thing, and everybody down there is very helpful. They do have to send in monthly timesheets where they show Ms. Wolfman that they are actually out there looking for jobs. We do give them supplemental payments if they turn in their worksheets. So it's kind of like we reward them for trying to help themselves, and it's been very beneficial to them. Adult financial programs are A&D CS for individuals 0 to 59 who are receiving Social Security due to a disability or blindness and are not receiving the full SSI benefit. And then ANDSO provides a cash assistance benefit to low-income Colorado residents who have a disability that precludes them from working. So the program provides interim financial assistance while they provide SSI benefits. Once they are approved for their Social Security benefits, our department is then reimbursed whatever we pay to them in the form of SSI. Old age pension was established in the state constitution in 1937 to provide cash benefits to individuals age 60 and older. And the individuals must pursue and accept all other potential income and resources that may be available to them before they receive this benefit. But they do have a maximum resource limit of $2,000 for a single person and $3,000 for married. We also have what is called the Low Energy Assistance Program, or LEAP, and it's a federally funded program that helps elderly, hardworking Colorado families, seniors, and individuals pay a portion of their winter home heating costs. LEAP works to keep our community warm during the winter months, November through April. It helps with heating costs, equipment repairs, or replacement of inoperable heating tools. And in most cases, the benefit is paid directly to the provider. And we also provide burial assistance, which is a payment to providers for burial or cremation services for low-income Coloradoans. And the maximum grant for that is $1,500. Benefits are used to cover reasonable and necessary costs for burial that do not exceed $2,500. And the person must be receiving public or medical assistance at the time of death. We also have the fraud program, which goes out and investigates any type of fraud referral that we are receiving. Currently, I have two gentlemen working on that. Mr. Martinez is doing a very good job in finding people that are doing trafficking with their food benefits. Unfortunately, people don't utilize their benefits once they are approved, and they do sell them, and we are trying to put an end to that. So he is very active in taking care of that. And let's see what else. And our notorious CCAP that you just heard, the problem we were all going through. We also oversee that program in our unit. And as you can see, we are the unit that does spend the money, but the outcome is generally helping those in need. And that's what we get paid to do. So any questions?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Garrison, thank you so much. Just a small question on your workforce development.
Mm-hmm.
Are those number recurring numbers? You have, for instance, September 54 clients, October 74. Are some of those, do they go from month to month, or do we have new clients every month?
Some of those go month to month.
Okay.
Other times they don't cooperate with the workforce development, and then they get shut down on the Colorado Works end, and then they have to reapply and come back on and get back on, get back in line with the workforce development. So those are Colorado Works recipients.
Okay. And the clients that receive employment, if I'm reading this chart properly, there is only four of them through September, October, November, and December, if I'm looking at the report correctly.
Let's see what you're looking at.
Number of clients who gain employment in general?
That's correct.
Okay.
Now also, though, Commissioner, keep in mind that Ms. Wolfram also works with our child support division, and those numbers are not necessarily reported here, but she will meet with upwards of 20 to 30 clients a month that she's also working on, either helping recruit gainful employment as well as educational opportunities, things of that nature as well. So this is reported specifically to the TANF programming funding that she's doing, but she also works extensively with our courts and with our child support services and provides services through them as well. And I will say this, our judge who handles child welfare really appreciates that portion, because she attends hearings on Thursdays with legal counsel, and she oftentimes is able to meet with clients right there, schedule them, bring them in, and start working on getting them compliant with their child support orders as well. So there's a lot of work that's being done on the back end that's not on this report specifically.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Garrison.
You're welcome.
Stay warm out there. All right, Mr. Aragon, do you have any anything else? Thank you for this. Today has been a very DHS 101 for all of us, so we really appreciate that too. If we have no other, I would like to, right at this point in time, entertain a motion to approve the caseload counts and activity by program, June and July.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. Consideration of letter of support, RECAP funding crisis on behalf of the Board of County Commissioners. Back to you, Mr. Aragon.
Commissioners, in front of you is a letter that at last meeting was requested. This is a letter to the Joint Budget Committee, and I don't know if for record legal, do we need to read this out loud, or does the board just... Okay.
Just resolution.
Okay. But again, this letter is regarding the CCAP program and a request to the state JVC to consider identifying and potentially moving funding to the child care program.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any questions or feedback on that.
Any questions on that letter, commissioners? There is another similar letter that it's on our packet that went directly to Representative Ty Winter. This one is Los Angeles County Department of Human Services. Basically, this is going to the Colorado Joint Budget Committee, State of Colorado Legislative Service, on behalf of Los Angeles County Board of Commissioners. What I have read the letter. We had a meeting last week with Mr. Aragon. What I also recommended to do is perhaps have this conversation at CCI. So CCI gets behind this letter as well, or a similar letter, sending it over to the JVC. And I think that would also carry a little more impact. So if you are, unless you have any other questions for Mr. Aragon, which he clearly states that Los Angeles County is going to be facing $568,000 shortfall. And then he goes and explains the whole thing. If there are no questions for Mr. Aragon, I will entertain a motion to approve this letter at this time.
So
Move to approve the letter of support for RECCAP funding crisis on behalf of the Board of County Commissioners.
Second motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. Section 7, consideration of financials and bills for November 2024. Back to you, Finance Director.
The finance records are in the packet for the month of November. Is there any questions regarding the expenses?
Do not. And for the record, highlight the expense amount.
The expense amount is $66,076.49.
Thank you. I don't have any questions, commissioners.
None.
I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve those financials.
Second.
Okay, Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. 7B, consideration of payroll for pay dates December 13th and 31st of 2024. Back to you, ma'am.
December 13th, 2024, the payroll, $121,593.36. This payroll did include the personal payout for the end of the year. December 31st, 2024, $112,181.62. Any questions?
By the way, I really appreciate the way they're lined out by month. That when I get these reports, I go to that page and then I backtrack. So thank you for doing that. I really appreciate that. Any questions for Finance Director? Thank you.
Yeah.
I will entertain a motion.
I move that the payroll for pay dates December 13th and 31st, 2024 be approved.
Second motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. And sincere and extensive thank you to all of you at DHS. What a tremendous work you do on behalf of our county and our city. So pass on those our gratitude to everyone. And Marcy, thank you for joining us. Great information. Keep coming back. Really appreciate hearing all that because that's so pertinent that we are up to date with all of that. So having no other items on the agenda, commissioners, I will entertain a motion to adjourn this Board of Human Services.
So moved.
Second motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez?
Yes. Thank you once again. Stay warm. Have a great, safe rest of the day and weekend.
Thank you.